applause from the crowd, and then a flash of light that Moist had come to associate with eventual trouble.
"Good evening, Mr. Dipvig," said the cheery voice of Otto Krieg. "My word, if we want news, all we have to do is follow you."
Moist ignored him and shouldered his way to Miss Deerhart, who, he noticed, was not beside herself with worry. "Is there a hospice in this city?" he said. "A decent doctor, even?"
"There's the Lady Sybil Free Hospital," said Miss Deerhart.
"Is it any good?"
"Some people don't die."
"That good, eh? Get him there right now. I've got to go back in for the cat."
"You are going to go back in there for a cat?"
"It's Tiddles," said Stanley primly. "He was born in the post office."
"Best not to argue," said Moist, turning to go. "See to Mr. Groat, will you?" Miss Deerhart looked down at the old man's blood-stained shirt.
"But it looks as though some creature tried to—"
she began.
"Something fell on him," said Moist shortly.
"That wouldn't cause—"
"Something fell on him," said Moist. "That's what happened."
She looked at his face.
"All right," she agreed.
"Something fell on him."
"Something with big claws?"
"No,
a joist with lots of nails in it, something like that. Anyone can see that."
"That's what happened, was it?"
said Miss Deerhart.
"That's exactly what happened," said Moist, and strode away before there were any more questions.
No point in getting the watch in this, he thought, hurrying toward the doors. They'll clump around and there won't be any answers for them, and in my experience, watchmen always like to arrest somebody.
"What makes you think it was Reach of Guilt, Mr. Lipvig, wasn't it?"
"Oh, you could tell, could you? That's a skill of yours, is it? Funny thing, we can tell sometimes too. You've got a very familiar face, Mr. Lipvig. Where are you from?"
No, there was no point in getting friendly with the watch. They might get in the way.
An upper window exploded outwards and flames licked along the edge of the roof. Moist ducked into the doorway as glass rained down. As for Tiddles, well, he had to find the damn cat. If he didn't, it wouldn't be fun any more. If he didn't risk at least a tiny bit of life and a smidgen of limb, he just wouldn't be able to carry on being him. Had he just thought that? Oh, gods, he'd lost it. He'd never been sure how he'd got it, but it was gone. That's what happened if you took wages. And hadn't his grandfather warned him to keep away from women as neurotic as a shaved monkey? Actually, he hadn't, his interest lying mainly with dogs and beer, but he should have. The vision of Mr. Groat's chest kept bumping insistently against his imagination. It looked as though something with claws had taken a swipe at him, and only the thick uniform coat prevented him from being opened like a clam. But that didn't sound like a vampire. They weren't messy like that. It was a waste of good food. Nevertheless, he picked up a piece of smashed chair. It had splintered nicely, and the nice thing about a stake through the heart was that it also worked on non-vampires. More ceiling had come down in the hall, but he was able to dodge between the debris. The main staircase was at this end and completely untouched, although smoke lay on the floor like a carpet. At the other end of the hall, where the mountains of old mail had been, the blaze still roared. He couldn't hear the letters any more. "Sorry," he thought. "I did my best. It wasn't my fault." What now? At least he could get his box out of his office. That couldn't be allowed to burn. Some of those chemicals would be quite hard to replace. The office was full of smoke, but he dragged the box out from under his desk and then spotted the golden suit on its hanger. He had to take it, didn't he? Something like that couldn't be allowed to burn. He could come back for the box, right? But the suit? The suit was necessary. There was no sign of Tiddles. He must have got out, yes? Didn't cats leave sinking ships, or was it rats? Wouldn't the cats follow the rats? Anyway, smoke was coming up between the floorboards and drifting down from the upper floors, and this wasn't the time to hang around. He'd looked everywhere sensible. There was no sense in being where a ton of burning paper could drop on your head. It was a good plan, and it was only spoiled when he spotted the cat down in the hall. It was watching him with interest. "Tiddles!" bellowed Moist. He wished he hadn't. It was such a stupid name to shout in the burning building. The cat looked at him and trotted away. Cursing, Moist hurried after it and saw it disappear down into the cellars. Cats were bright, weren't they? There was probably another way out, bound to be. Moist didn't even look up when he heard the creaking of wood overhead, but ran forward and went down the steps five at a time. By the sound of it, a large amount of the entire building smashed into the floor just behind him, and sparks roared down the cellar passage, burning his neck. Well, there was no going back, at least. But cellars, now, they had trapdoors and coal chutes and things, didn't they? And they were cool and safe and just the place where you'd go to lick your wounds after being smashed in the mouth with a sackful of pins, right? An imagination is a terrible thing to bring along. A vampire, she'd said, and Stanley had hit a big bird with a sackful of pins. Stanley the Vampire Slayer, with a bag of pins. You wouldn't believe it unless you'd seen him in one of what Mr. Grote called his little moments. You probably couldn't kill a vampire with pins. And after a thought like that is when you realise that however hard you try to look behind you, there's a behind you, where you aren't looking. Moist flung his back to the cold stone wall and slithered along it until he ran out of wall and acquired a doorframe. The faint blue glow of the sorting engine was just visible. As Moist peered into the machine's room, Tiddles was visible too. He was crouched under the engine. "That's a very cat thing you're doing there, Tiddles," said Moist, staring at shadows. "Come to Uncle Moist, please." He sighed and hung the suit on an old letter rack and crouched down. How were you supposed to pick up a cat? He'd never done it. Cats never figured in Grandfather's Lipwigser kennels except as an impromptu snack. As his hands drew near Tiddles, the cat flattened its ears and hissed. "Do you want to cook down here?" said Moist. "No claws, please." The cat began to growl, and Moist realised it wasn't looking directly at him. "Good, Tiddles," he said, feeling the terror begin to rise. It was one of the prime directives of exploring in a hostile environment. Do not bother about the cat. And suddenly the environment was a lot more hostile. Another important rule was, don't turn around too slowly to look. It's there all right. Not the cat. Damn the cat, it's something else. He stood upright and took a two-handed grip on the wooden stake. "It's right behind me, yes," he thought. "Bloody well, bloody right, bloody behind me. Of course it is. How could things be otherwise?" The feeling of fear was almost the same as the feeling he got when, say, a mark was examining a glass diamond. Time slowed a little, every sense was heightened, and there was a taste of copper in his mouth. "Don't turn around slowly, turn around fast." He spun, screamed, and thrust. The stake met resistance, which yielded only slightly. A long, pale face grinned at him in the blue light. It showed rows of pointy teeth. "Missed both my hearts," said Mr. Grile, spitting blood. Moist jumped back as a thin, clawed hand sliced through the air, but kept the stake in front of him, jabbing with it, holding the thing back. "Banshee," he thought. "Oh, hell." Only when he moved did Grile's leathery cape swing aside briefly to show the skeletal figure beneath. It helped if he knew that the black leather was a wing. It helped if you thought of banshees as the only humanoid race that had evolved the ability to fly in some lush jungle somewhere where they'd hunted flying squirrels. It didn't help much if you knew why the story went that hearing the scream of the banshee meant that you were going to die. It meant that the banshee was tracking you. No good looking behind you, it was overhead. There weren't many of the feral ones, even in Uberwald, but Moist knew the advice passed on by people who'd survived them. Keep away from the mouth. Those teeth were vicious. Don't attack the chest. The flight muscles there are like armour. They're not strong, but they've got sinews like steel cables. And the long reach on those arm bones will mean it can slap your silly head right off. Tiddles yowled and backed further under the sorting engine. Grile slashed at Moist again and came after him as he backed away. But their necks snap easily if you can get inside their reach, and they have to shut their eyes when they scream. Grile came towards him, head bobbing as he strutted. There was nowhere else for Moist to go, so he tossed aside the wood and held up his hands. "All right, I give in," he said. "Just make it quick, okay?" The creature kept looking at the golden suit. They had a magpie's eye for glitter. "I'm going somewhere afterwards," said Moist helpfully. Grile hesitated. He was hurt, disoriented, and had eaten pigeons that were effluent on wings. He wanted to get out of here and up into the cool sky. Everything was too complicated here. There were too many targets, too many smells. For a banshee, everything was in the pounce, when teeth, claws, and body weight all bore down at once. Now, bewildered, he strutted back and forth, trying to deal with the situation. There was no room to fly, nowhere else to go. The prey was standing there. Instinct, emotion, and some attempt at rational thought all banged together in Grile's overheated head. Instinct won. Leaping at things with your claws out had worked for a million years, so why stop now? He threw his head back, screamed, and sprang. So did Moist, ducking under the long arms. that wasn't programmed into the Banshee's responses. The prey should be huddled or running away. But Moist's shoulder caught him in the chest. The creature was as light as a child. Moist felt a claw slash into his arm as he hurled the thing onto the sorting engine and flung himself to the floor. For one horrible moment he thought it was going to get up, that he'd missed the wheel, but as the enraged Mr. Grile shifted, there was a sound like gloop, followed by silence. Moist lay on the cool flagstones until his heart slowed down to the point where he could make out individual beats. He was aware, as he lay there, that something sticky was dripping down the side of the machine. He arose slowly on unsteady legs and stared at what had become of the creature. If he'd been a hero, he would have taken the opportunity to say, "That's what I call sorted." Since he wasn't a hero, he threw up. A body doesn't work properly when significant bits are not sharing the same space-time frame as the rest of it, but it does look more colourful. The trade-off is not to its advantage. Then, clutching at his bleeding arm, he knelt down and looked under the engine for Tiddles. He had to come back with the cat, he thought muzzily. It was just something that had to happen. A man who rushes into a burning building to rescue a stupid cat and comes out carrying the cat is seen as a hero, even if he is a rather dumb one. If he comes out sans cat, he's a twit. A muffled thunder above them suggested that part of the building had fallen down. The air was roasting. Tiddles backed away from Moist's hand. "Listen," Moist growled. "The hero has to come out with the cat. The cat doesn't have to be alive." He lunged, grabbed Tiddles, and dragged the cat out. "Right," he said, and picked up the suit hanger in his other hand. There were a few blobs of Banshee on it, but, he thought lightheartedly, he could probably find something to remove it. He lurched out into the corridor. There was a wall of fire at both ends, and Tiddles chose this moment to sink all four claws into his arm. "Ah," said Moist. "Up until now it was going so well."
"Mr. Lipwig, are you all right, Mr. Lipwig?"
What golems removed from a fire was, in fact, the fire. They took out of a burning property everything that was burning. It was curiously surgical. They assembled at the edge of the fire and deprived it of anything to burn, herded it, cornered it, stamped it to death. Golems could wade through lava and pour molten iron. Even if they knew what fear was, they wouldn't find it in a mere burning building. Glowing rubble was hauled away from the steps by red-hot hands. Moist stared up into a landscape of flame, but also, in front of it, Mr. Pump. He was glowing orange. Specks of dust and dirt on his clay flashed and sparkled.
"Good to see you, Mr. Lipwig," he boomed cheerfully, tossing a crackling beam aside. "We have cleared a path to the door. Move with speed."
"Thank you," Moist shouted above the roar of the flames. There was a path, dragged clear of debris, with the open door beckoning calmly and coolly at the end of it. Away, toward the far end of the hall, other golems, red-hot in the pillars of flame, were calmly throwing burning floorboards out through a hole in the wall. The heat was intense. Moist lowered his head, clutched the terrified cat to his chest, felt the back of his neck begin to roast, and scampered forward. From then on, it became all one memory. The crashing noise high above, the metallic boom, the golem Anghammerad looking up, with his message glowing yellow on his cherry-red arm. 10,000 tons of rainwater pouring down in deceptive slow motion. The cold hitting the glowing golem. The explosion. Flames died. Sound died. Light died.
Anghammerad.
Anghammerad looked at his hands. There was nothing there except heat, furnace heat, blasting heat, that nevertheless made the shapes of fingers.
Anghammerad, a hollow voice repeated. I have lost my clay, said the golem. Yes, said Death. That is standard. You are dead. Smashed. Exploded into a million pieces. Then who is this doing the listening? Everything there was about you that isn't clay. Do you have a command for me? Said the remains of Anghammerad, standing up. Not now. You have reached the place where there are no more orders. What should I do? I believe you have failed to understand my last comment.
Ang Hammerad sat down again. Apart from the fact that there was sand rather than ooze underfoot, this place reminded him of the abyssal plain.
"Generally people like to move on," Death hinted. "They look forward to an afterlife."
"I will stay here, please."
"Here? There's nothing to do here," said Death.
"Yes and no," said the ghost of the golem.
"It is perfect. I am free."
At 2 in the morning, it began to rain. Things could have been worse. It could have rained snakes. It could have rained acid. There was still some roof and some walls. That meant there was still some building. Moist and Miss Dearheart sat on some warm rubble outside the locker room, which was more or less the only room that could still be properly described as one. The golems had stamped out the last of the fire, shored things up, and then, without a word, had gone back to not being a hammer until sunset. Miss Dearheart held a half-melted bronze band in her hand and turned it over and over again. 18,000 years, she whispered. "It was the rainwater tank," mumbled Moist, staring at nothing. "Fire and water," muttered Miss Dearheart, "but not both. Can't you re-bake him or something?" It sounded hopeless even as Moist said it. He'd seen the other golems scrabbling in the rubble. "Not enough left. Just dust. Mixed up with everything else," said Miss Dearheart. "All he wanted to do was be useful." Moist looked at the remains of the letters. The flood had washed the black slurry of their ashes into every corner. All they wanted to do was be delivered, he thought. At a time like this, sitting on the seabed for 9,000 years seemed quite attractive. "He was going to wait until the universe came round again, did you know that?"
"You told me, yes," said Moist.
"There's no stink more sorrowful than the stink of wet, burned paper," Moist thought. "It means the end." "Vetinari won't rebuild this place, you know," Miss Dearheart went on. "Guilt will get people to make a fuss if he tries it. Waste of city funds. He's got friends. People who owe him money and favours. He's good at that sort of people." "It was guilt who had this place torched," said Moist. "He was shocked to see me back in the restaurant. He thought I'd be here. You'll never be able to prove it." "Probably not," Moist agreed, in the sour, smoke-addled hollow of his head. The watch had turned up with more speed than Moist had found usual among city policemen. They had a werewolf with them. Oh, probably most people would have thought it was just a handsome dog, but grow up in Uberwald with a grandfather who bred dogs, and you learn to spot the signs. This one had a collar, and snuffled around while the embers were still smoking, and found something extra to scent in the pall of steaming ashes. They dug down, and there had been an awkward interview. Moist had handled it as well as he could manage under the circumstances. The key point was never to tell the truth. Coppers never believed what people told them in any case, so there was no point in giving them extra work. "A winged skeleton," Moist had said, with what surely sounded like genuine surprise.
"Yes, sir. About the size of a man, but very damaged. I could even say mangled. I wonder if you know anything about it."
This watchman was a captain. Moist hadn't been able to make him out. His face gave nothing away that he didn't want to let go of. Something about him suggested that he already knew the answers but was asking the questions, the look of the thing. "Perhaps it was an extra-large pigeon. They're real pests in this building," he'd said.
"I doubt it, sir. We believe it to have been a banshee, Miss Lipvig," said the captain patiently. "They're very rare."
"I thought they just screamed on the rooftops of people who were going to die," said Moist.
"The civilized ones do, sir. The wild ones cut out the middleman. Your young man said he hit something."
"Stanley did say something about, something flying around," said Moist, "but I thought it was simply
an extra-large pigeon, I see. And you've no idea how the fire started? I know you use safety lamps in here."
"Probably spontaneous combustion in the letter piles, I'm afraid," said Moist, who'd had time to think about this one.
"No one has been behaving oddly. In the post office, Captain, it's very hard to tell, believe me. No threats made, sir, by anyone you might have upset, perhaps?"
"None at all." The captain had sighed and put away his notebook.
"I'll have a couple of men watching the building overnight, nevertheless," he said. "Well done for saving the cat, sir. That was a big cheer you got when you came out. Just one thing, though, sir."
"Yes, Captain."
"Why would a banshee, or possibly a giant pigeon, attack Mr. Groot?"
And Moist thought, "The hat."
"I have no idea," he said. "Yes, sir. I'm sure you haven't," said the captain. "I'm sure you haven't.
"'I'm Captain Iron Founderson, sir, although most people call me Captain Carrot. "'Don't hesitate to contact me, sir, if anything occurs to you. "'We are here for your protection.'
"'And what would you have done against a banshee?' Moist had thought. "'You suspect guilt, well done. "'But people like guilt don't bother with the law. "'They never break it, they just use people who do. "'And you'll never find anything written down anywhere.'
"'Just before the captain turned to go, "'Moist was sure that the werewolf winked at him. "'Now, with the rain drifting in and hissing where the stones were still warm, "'Moist looked around at the fires.' There were still plenty of them, where the golems had dumped the rubble. This being Ankh-Morpork, people of the night had risen like mists and gathered around them for warmth. This place would need a fortune spent on it. Well, he knew where to lay his hands on plenty of money, didn't he? He didn't have much use for it. It had only ever been a way of keeping score. But then this would all end, because it had belonged to Albert Spangler and the rest of them, not to an innocent postmaster. He took off his golden hat and looked at it. An avatar, Pelk had said. The human embodiment of a god. But he wasn't a god, he was just a con man in a golden suit, and the con was over. Where was the angel now? Where were the gods when you needed them? The gods could help. The hat glinted in the firelight, and parts of Moist's brain sparkled. He didn't breathe as the thought emerged, in case it took flight, but it was so simple, and something that no honest man would ever have thought of. "'What we need is,' he said, "'is what?' said Miss Dearheart. "'Is music,' declared Moist. He stood up and cupped his hands. "'Hey, you people, any banjo players out there? A fiddle, maybe? I'll give a $1 stamp, highly collectible, to anyone who can pick out a waltz tune. You know, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. "'Have you gone completely mad?' said Miss Dearheart. "'You're clearly—' She stopped because a shabbily dressed man had tapped Moist on the shoulder. "'I can play the banjo,' he said. "'And my friend Amphrey here can play the harmonica, something cruel. "'The fee will be $1, sir. "'Coin, please, if it's all the same to you, "'on account of how I can't write and don't know anyone who can read.'
"'My lovely Miss Dearheart,' said Moist, smiling madly at her. "'Do you have any other name? "'Some pet name or nickname? "'Some delightful little diminutive you don't mind being called?'
"'Are you drunk?' she demanded.
"'Unfortunately, no,' said Moist. "'But I'd like to be.'
"'Well, Miss Dearheart, I even rescued my best suit.' She was clearly taken aback, but an answer escaped before natural cynicism could bar the door. "'My brother used to call me, "'Yes?'
"'Killer?'
said Miss Dearheart. "'But he meant it in a nice way. Don't you even think about using it.
"'How about Spike?'
"'Spike? Well, I could live with Spike,' said Miss Dearheart.
"'So will you, too. But this is not the time for dancing.'
"'On the contrary, Spike,' said Moist, beaming in the firelight, "'this is just the time. We'll dance, and then we'll get things cleaned up, ready for opening time, get the mail delivery working again, order the rebuilding of the building, and have everything back the way it was. Just watch me.'
"'You know, perhaps it is true that working for the post office drives people mad,' said Miss Dearheart. "'Just where will you get the money to have this place rebuilt?'
"'The gods will provide,' said Moist. "'Trust me on this.'
She peered at him.
"'You're serious?'
"'Deadly,' said Moist.
"'You're going to pray for money?'
"'Not exactly, Spike. They get thousands of prayers every day. I have other plans. We'll bring the post office back, Miss Dearheart. I don't have to think like a policeman or a postman or a clerk. I just have to do things my way, and then I'll bankrupt Reacher Guilt by the end of the week.'
Her mouth became a perfect O.
"'How exactly will you do that?' she managed.
"'I've no idea. But anything is possible if I can dance with you and still have 10 toes left. Shall we dance, Miss Dearheart?'
She was amazed and surprised and bewildered, and Moist Fund Lipfig liked that in a person. For some reason he felt immensely happy. He didn't know why, and he didn't know what he was going to do next. But it was going to be fun. He could feel that old electric feeling, the one you got deep inside when you stood right there in front of a banker who was carefully examining an example of your very best work. The universe held its breath, and then the man would smile and say, "'Very good, Mr. Assumed Name. I will have my clerk bring up the money right away.' It was the thrill not of the chase but of the standing still, of remaining so calm, composed, and genuine, that for just long enough you could fool the world and spin it on your finger. These were the moments he lived for, when he was really alive, and his thoughts flowed like quicksilver, and the very air sparkled. Later, that feeling would present its bill. For now, he flew. He was back in the game, but for now, by the light of the burning yesterdays, he waltzed with Miss Dearheart while the scratch band scratched away. Then she went home to bed, puzzled but smiling oddly, and he went up to his office, which was missing the whole of one wall, and got religion as it had never been got before. The young priest of Offla the Crocodile God was somewhat off balance at 4 a.m., but the man in the winged hat and golden suit seemed to know what should be happening, and so the priest went along with it. He was not hugely bright, which was why he was on this shift.
"Ah, you want to deliver this letter to Offla?" he said, yawning.
An envelope had been placed in his hand.
"It's addressed to him," said Moist, "and correctly stamped. A smartly written letter always gets attention. I've also brought a pound of sausages, which I believe is customary. Crocodiles love sausages."
Strictly speaking, you see, it's prayers that go up to the gods," said the priest doubtfully.
The nave of the temple was deserted except for a little old man in a grubby robe, dreamily sweeping the floor.
"As I understand it," said Moist, "the gift of sausages reaches Offla by being fried, yes? And the spirit of the sausages ascends unto Offla by means of the smell, and then you eat the sausages."
"Ah, no, not exactly. Not at all," said the young priest, who knew this one. "It might look that way to the uninitiated, but as you say, the true sausagidity goes straight to Offla. He, of course, eats the spirit of the sausages. We eat the mere earthy shell, which, believe me, turns to dust and ashes in our mouths.
That would explain why the smell of sausages is always better than the actual sausage, then," said Moist. "I've often noticed that."
The priest was impressed.
"Are you a theologian, sir?" he said.
"I'm in a similar line of work," said Moist. "But what I'm getting at is this. If you were to read this letter, it would be as though Offla himself was reading it. Am I right? Through your eyeballs, the spirits of the letter would ascend to Offla, and then I could give you the sausages."
The young priest looked desperately around the temple. It was too early in the morning. When your god, metaphorically, doesn't do much until the sandbanks have got nice and warm, the senior priests tend to lie in.
"I suppose so," he said reluctantly. "But wouldn't you rather wait until Deacon Jones gets—"
"I'm in rather a hurry," said Moist.
There was a pause.
"I've brought some honey mustard," he added. "The perfect accompaniment to sausages."
Suddenly the priest was all attention.
"What sort?"
he said.
"Mrs. Edith Leacall's Premium Reserve," said Moist, holding up the jar.
The young man's face lit up. He was low in the hierarchy and got barely more sausage than Offla.
"God, that's the expensive stuff," he breathed.
"Yes, it's the hint of wild garlic that does it," said Moist. "But perhaps I should wait until Deacon—"
The priest grabbed the letter and the jar.
"No, no, I can see you are in a hurry," he said. "I'll do it right away. It's probably a request for help, yes?"
"Yes, I'd like Offla to let the light of his eyes and the gleam on his teeth shine on my colleague Tolliver Groat, who is in the Lady Sybil Hospital," said Moist.
"Oh, yes," said the acolyte, relieved. "We often do this sort of—"
"And I would also like $150,000, Moist went on. "Ankh Morpork dollars preferred, of course, but other reasonably hard currencies would be acceptable."
There was a certain spring in his step as Moist walked back to the ruin of the post office. He'd sent letters to Offla, Om, and Blind Io, all important gods, and also to Anoia, a minor goddess of things that stick in drawers. Often, but not uniquely, a ladle, but sometimes a metal spatula, or rarely, a mechanical egg whisk that nobody in the house admits to ever buying. The desperate, mad rattling and cries of, "How can it close on the damn thing but not open with it? Who bought this? Do we ever use it?" is as praise unto Anoia. She also eats corkscrews. She had no temple and was handled by a jobbing priestess in Cable Street, but Moist had a feeling that by the end of the day Anoia was destined for higher things. He only picked her because he liked the name. He'd leave it about an hour. Gods worked fast, didn't they? The post office was no better by grey daylight. About half of the building was still standing. Even with tarpaulins, the area under cover was small and dank. People were milling around, uncertain of what to do. He'd tell them. The first person he saw was George Aggie, heading for him in a high-speed hobble.
"Terrible thing, sir! Terrible thing! I came as soon as—"
he began. "Good to see you, George. How's the leg?"
"What? Oh, feels fine, sir. Glows in the dark. But on the other hand, it's a great saving in candles. What are we—"
"You're my deputy while Mr. Groat's in hospital," said Moist. "How many postmen can you muster?"
"About a dozen, sir. But what shall we—"
"Get the mail moving, Mr. Aggie. That's what we do. Tell everyone that today's special is Pseudopolis for 10p guaranteed. Everyone else can get on with the cleaning up. There's still some roof left. We're open as usual. More open than usual."
"But—"
Aggie's words failed him, and he waved at the debris.
"All this—"
"Neither rain nor fire, Mr. Aggie," said Moist sharply.
"Doesn't say that on the motto, sir,"
said Aggie. "It will by tomorrow." "Ah, Jim." The coachman bore down on Moist, his enormous driving cape flapping.
"It was bloody guilt, wasn't it?" he growled. "Arson around. What can we do for you, Mr. Lipvig?"
"Can you still run a service to Pseudopolis today?" said Moist.
"Yes," said Jim. "Harry and the lads got all the horses out as soon as they smelled smoke, and only lost one coach. We'll help you damn right about that, but the trunk is running okay. You'll be wasting your time."
"You provide the wheels, Jim, and I'll give them something to carry," said Moist. "We'll have a bag for you at 10.
"You're very certain, Mr. Lipvig,"
said Jim, putting his head to one side. "An angel came and told me in my sleep," said Moist. Jim grinned.
"Ah, oh, that'll be it, then. An angel, eh? A very pleasant help in time of trouble, or so I'm given to understand."
"So I believe," said Moist, and went up to the draughty, smoke-blackened, three-walled cave that was the wreckage of his office. He brushed off the ash from the chair, reached into his pocket, and put the smoking Ganoo's letter on his desk. The only people who could know when a Clax Tower would break down must work for the company, right? Or used to work for it, more likely. Ha! That's how things happened. That bank in Stolat, for example. He'd never have been able to forge those bills if that bent clerk hadn't sold him that old ledger with all the signatures in it. That had been a good day. The Grand Trunk mustn't just make enemies, it must mass-produce them. And now this smoking Ganoo wanted to help him. Outlaw signallers. Think of all the secrets they'd know. He kept an ear open for clock chimes, and it was gone 9:15 now. What would they do? Blow up a tower? But people worked in the towers. Surely not.
Or Mr. Lipvig.
It is not often that a wailing woman rushes into a room and throws herself at a man. It had never happened to Moist before. Now it happened, and it seemed such a waste that the woman was Miss McAlariat. She tottered forward and clung to the startled Moist, tears streaming down her face.
"Oh, Mr. Lipvig," she railed. "Oh, Mr. Lipvig."
Moist reeled under her weight. She was dragging at his collar so hard that he was likely to end up on the floor, and the thought of being found on the floor with Miss McAlariat was, well, a thought that just couldn't be thoughted. The head would explode before thoughting it. She had a pink hair grip in her grey hair. It had little hand-painted violets on it. The sight of it, a few inches from Moist's eyes, was curiously disturbing.
Now, steady on, Miss McAlariat, steady on," he muttered, trying to keep the balance for both of them. "Oh, Mr. Lipwig."
"Yes, indeed, Miss McAlariat," he said desperately. "What can I do for—"
"Mr. Aggie said the post office won't ever be rebuilt. He says Lord Veterinari will never release the money. Oh, Mr. Lipwig, I dreamed all my life of working on the counter here. My grandmother taught me everything. She even made me practice sucking lemons to get the expression right. I've passed it on to my daughter, too. She's got a voice that'll take the skin off paint. Oh, Mr. Lipvig!"
Moist searched wildly for somewhere to pat the woman, some place that wasn't soaked or out of bounds. He settled for her shoulder. He really, really needed Mr. Groat. Mr. Groat knew how to deal with things like this. "It's all going to be all right, Miss McAlariat," he said soothingly.
"And poor Mr. Groat!" the woman sobbed.
"I understand he's going to be fine, Miss McAlariat. You know what they said about the Lady Sybil? Some people come out alive. I really, really hope he does," he added to himself. "I'm lost without him."
"It's all so dreadful, Mr. Lipvig,"
said Miss McAlariat, determined to drain the bitter cup of despair to the very dregs.
"We're all going to be walking the streets."
Moist held her by the arms and pushed her gently away, while fighting against a mental picture of Miss McAlariat walking the streets. "Now, you listen to me, Miss Mac—" "What is your first name, by the way?"
"It's Iodine, Mr. Lipvig,"
said Miss McAlariat, snuffling into a handkerchief.
"My father liked the sound."
"Well,
iodine, I firmly believe that I will have the money to rebuild by the end of the day, said Moist.
She's blown her nose on it, and yes, yes, ah, she's going to put it back up the sleeve of her cardigan. Oh, gods.
Yes, Mr. Aggie said that, and there's talk, sir. They say you sent the gods letters asking for money. Oh, sir, it's not my place to say so, sir, but gods don't send you money.
I have faith, Miss McAlariat, said Moist, drawing himself up.
My family have been annoyance for 5 generations, sir, said Miss McAlariat. We rattle the drawers every day, and we've never got anything solid, as you might say, excepting my granny, who got an egg beater she didn't remember putting there, and we're sure that was an accident.
Mr. Litwig! Mr. Litwig! Someone yelled. They say the clacks... Oh, I'm so sorry!
The sentence ended in syrup. Moist sighed and turned to the grinning newcomer in the charcoal-rimmed doorway.
Yes, Mr. Aggie.
We've had the clacks has gone down again, sir, to Pseudopolis, said Aggie.
How unfortunate, said Moist.
Come, Miss McAlariat, come, Mr. Aggie, let's move the mail.
There was a crowd in what remained of the hall. As Moist had observed, the citizens had an enthusiasm for new things. The post was an old thing, of course, but it was so old that it had magically become new again. A cheer greeted Moist when he came down the steps. Give them a show, always give them a show. Ankh-Morpork would applaud a show. Moist commandeered a chair, stood on it, and cupped his hands.
"Special today, ladies and gentlemen," he shouted above the din. "Mail to Pseudopolis, reduced to 3 pence only. 3 pence. Coach goes at 10. And if anyone has clax messages lodged with our unfortunate colleagues in the Grand Trunk Company and would care to get them back, we will deliver them for free."
This caused an additional stir, and a number of people peeled away from the crowd and hurried off.
"The post office, ladies and gentlemen," yelled Moist. "We deliver!"
There was a cheer.
"Do you want to know something really interesting, Mr. Litwig?"
said Stanley, hurrying up.
"And what's that, Stanley?" said Moist, climbing down off the chair. "We're selling lots of the new $1 stamps this morning, and do you know what? People are sending letters to themselves."
"What?" said Moist, mystified.
"Just so the stamps have been through the post, sir. That makes them real, you see. It proves they've been used. They are collecting them, sir. And it gets better, sir."
"How could it get better than that?" said Moist. He looked down. Yes, the boy had a new shirt, showing a picture of the penny stamp and bearing the legend, "Ask me about stamps."
"Stowlat want Teamer and Spools to do them their own set, and the other cities are asking about it too."
Moist made a mental note. "We'll change the stamps often, and offer stamp designs to every city and country we can think of. Everyone will want to have their own stamps rather than lick Vetinari's backside. And we'll honour them, too, if they'll deliver our mail, and Mr. Spools will express his gratitude to us in very definite ways. I'll see to it."
"Sorry about your pins, Stanley."
"Pins?" said the boy.
"Oh, pins. Pins are just pointy metal things, sir. Pins are dead."
"And so we progress," thought Moist. "Always keep moving. There may be something behind you. All we need now is for the gods to smile on us."
I think they'll smile a little broader outside."
Moist stepped out into the daylight. The difference between the inside and outside of the post office was less marked than formerly, but there were still a lot of people. There were a couple of watchmen, too. They'd be useful. They were already watching him suspiciously. Well, this was it. It was going to be a miracle. Actually, it bloody well was going to be a miracle. Moist stared up into the sky and listened to the voices of the gods. Chapter 11. Mission Statement. In which Lord Vetinari gives advice. Mr. Litvig's bad memory. Evil criminal geniuses, difficulty with finding property. Mr. Groat's fear of bathing, and a discussion on explosive underwear. Mr. Pony and his flimsies. The board debates, guilt decides. Moist von Litvig attempts the impossible. The clocks were chiming 7 o'clock.
"Ah, Mr. Litwig," said Lord Vetinari, looking up. "Thank you so much for dropping in. It has been such a busy day, has it not? Drumknot, do help Mr. Litwig to a chair. Prophecy can be very exhausting, I believe."
Moist waved the clerk away and eased his aching body into a seat. "I didn't exactly decide to drop in," he said. "A large troll watchman walked in and grabbed me by the arm."
"Ah, to steady you, I have no doubt," said Lord Vetinari, who was poring over the battle between the stone trolls and the stone dwarfs. "You accompanied him of your own free will, did you not?"
"I'm very attached to my arm,"
said Moist. "I thought I'd better follow it. What can I do for you, my lord?" Vetinari got up and went and sat in the chair behind his desk, where he regarded Moist with what almost looked like amusement. "Commander Vimes has given me some succinct reports of today's events," he said, putting down the troll figure he was holding and turning over a few sheets of paper. "Beginning with the riot at the Grand Trunk offices this morning, which he says you instigated. All I did was volunteer to deliver such clacks messages as had been held up by the unfortunate breakdown," said Moist. "I didn't expect the idiots in their office to refuse to hand the messages back to their customers. People have paid in advance, after all. I was just helping everyone in a difficult time, and I certainly didn't instigate anyone to hit a clerk with a chair." "Of course not, of course not," said Lord Vetinari. "I am sure you acted quite innocently, and from the best of intentions. But I am agog to hear about the gold, Mr. Moist. $150,000, I believe." "Some of it I can't quite remember," said Moist. "It's all a bit unclear."
"Yes, yes, I imagine it is. Perhaps I can clarify a few details," said Lord Vetinari. "Around mid-morning, Mr. Lipwig, you were chatting to people outside your regrettably distressed building when—here the patrician glanced at his notes—you suddenly looked up, shielded your eyes, dropped to your knees and screamed, 'Yes, yes, thank you, I am not worthy. Glory be, may your teeth be picked clean by birds, hallelujah, rattle your drawers,' and similar phrases, to the general concern of people nearby. And you then stood up with your hands outstretched and shouted, 150,000 dollars buried in a field. Thank you, I shall fetch it immediately.' Whereupon you wrested a shovel from one of the men helping to clear the debris of the building, and began to walk with some purpose out of the city."
"Really?" said Moist.
"It's all a bit of a blank."
"I'm sure it is," said Vetinari, nodding.
"You will probably be quite surprised to know that a number of people followed you, Mr. Lipwig, including Mr. Pump and two members of the City Watch."
"Good heavens, did they?"
"Quite. For several hours. You stopped to pray on a number of occasions. We must assume it was for the guidance which led your footsteps at last to a small wood among the cabbage fields."
"It did? I'm afraid it's all rather a blur," said Moist.
"I understand you dug like a demon, according to the watch, and I note that a number of reputable witnesses were there when your shovel struck the lid of the chest. I understand the Times will be carrying a picture in the next edition."
Moist said nothing. It was the only way to be sure.
"Any comments, Mr. Lipwig?"
"No, my lord, not really."
"About 3 hours ago, I had the senior priests of three of the major religions in this office, along with a rather bewildered freelance priestess, who I gather handles the worldly affairs of Anoia on an agency basis. They all claim that it was their god or goddess who told you where the gold was. You don't happen to remember which one it was, do you?"
"I sort of felt the voice rather than heard it," said Moist carefully.
"Quite so," said Vetinari. "Incidentally, they all felt that their temple should get a tithe of the money," he added. "Each."
$60,000, said Moist, sitting up. "That's not right."
"I commend the speed of your mental arithmetic in your shaken state."
"No lack of clarity there, I'm glad to see," said Vetinari.
"I would advise you to donate 50,000 split four ways. It is, after all, in a very public and very definite and incontrovertible way, a gift from the gods. Is this not a time for reverential gratitude?"
There was a lengthy pause, and then Moist raised a finger and managed, against all the odds, a cheerful smile.
"Sound advice, my lord. Besides, a man never knows when he might need a prayer."
"Exactly," said Lord Vetinari. "It is less than they demanded, but more than they expect. And I did point out to them that the remainder of the money was all going to be used for the civic good."
"It is going to be used for the civic good, isn't it, Mr. Lipwig?"
"Oh, yes, indeed."
That is just as well, since currently it's sitting in Commander Vimes's cells. Vetinari looked down at Moist's trousers. I see you still have mud all over your lovely golden suit, Postmaster. Fancy all that money being buried in a field. And you can still remember nothing about how you got there? Vetinari's expression was getting on Moist's nerves. You know, he thought. I know you know. You know, I know you know. But I know you can't be certain. Not certain. Well, there was an angel, he said. Indeed. Any particular kind? The kind you only get one of, I think, said Moist. Ah, good. Well, then, it all seems very clear to me, said Vetinari, sitting back. It is not often a mortal man achieves such a moment of glorious epiphany, but I am assured by the priests that such a thing could happen, and who should know better than they? Anyone even suggesting that the money was in some way obtained in some wrong fashion will have to argue with some very turbulent priests, and also, I assume, find their kitchen drawers quite impossible to shut. Besides, you are donating the money to the city. He held up his hand when Moist opened his mouth and went on. That is, the post office. So the notion of private gain does not arise. There appears to be no owner for the money, although so far, of course, 938 people would like me to believe it belongs to them. Such is life in Ankh-Morpork. So, Mr. Lipvig, you are instructed to rebuild the post office as soon as possible. The bills will be met, and, since the money is effectively a gift from the gods, there will be no drain on our taxes. Well done, Mr. Lipvig. Very well done. Don't let me detain you. Moist actually had his hand on the door handle when the voice behind him said, Just one minor thing, Mr. Lipvig. He turned. Lord Vetinari had walked over to his game. Yes, sir? It occurs to me that the sum which the gods so generously have seen fit to bestow upon us does, by pure happenstance, appear to equal the estimated haul of a notorious criminal, which, as far as I know, has never been recovered. Moist stared at the woodwork in front of him. Why is this man ruling just one city, he thought. Why isn't he ruling the world? Is this how he treats other people? It's like being a puppet. The difference is, he arranges for you to pull your own strings. He turned, face carefully deadpan. Really, sir? Who was that, then? He said. One Alfred Spangler, Mr. Lipvig. He's dead, sir, said Moist. Are you sure? Yes, sir. I was there when they hanged him. Well remembered, Mr. Lipvig, said Vetinari, moving a dwarf all the way across the board. Damn, 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 Moist shouted, but only for internal consumption. He'd worked hard for that Well, the banks and merchants had worked hard. Well, somewhere down the line, someone had worked hard for that money. And now a third of it had been, well, stolen, that was the only word for it. Moist experienced a certain amount of unrighteous indignation about this. Of course, he would have given most of it to the post office, that was the whole point. But you could build a damn good building for a lot less than $100,000, and Moist had been hoping for a little something for himself. Still, he felt good. Perhaps this was that warm and fuzzy, wonderful warm feeling people talked about. And what would he have done with the money? He'd never have time to spend it in any case. After all, what could a master criminal buy? There was a shortage of seaside properties with real lava flows near a reliable source of piranhas, and the world as sure as hell didn't need another Dark Lord, not with Gilt doing so well. Gilt didn't need a tower with 10,000 trolls camped outside. He just needed a ledger and a sharp mind. It worked better, cheaper, and he could go out and party at night. Handing all that gold over to a copper had been a difficult thing to do, but there really was no choice. He'd got them by the short and curlies anyway. No one was going to stand up and say the gods didn't do this sort of thing. True, they'd never done it so far, but you could never tell with gods. Certainly there were queues outside the three temples once the Times had put out its afternoon edition. This had presented the priesthoods with a philosophical problem. They were officially against people laying up treasures on earth, but they had to admit it was always good to get bums on pews, feet in sacred groves, hands rattling drawers, and fingers being trailed in the baby alligator pool. They settled, therefore, for a kind of twinkle-eyed denial that it could happen again, while hinting that, well, you never know, ineffable are the ways of gods, eh? Besides,
Petitioners, standing in line with their letter asking for a big bag of cash, were open to the suggestion that those most likely to receive it were the ones who'd already giveth and got the message once you tapped them on the head with the collecting plate a few times. Even Miss Extramelia Mume, whose small, multi-purpose temple over a bookmaker's office in Cable Street handled the worldly affairs of several dozen minor gods, was doing good business amongst those prepared to back an outside chance. She'd hung a banner over the door. It read, "It could be you." It couldn't happen. It shouldn't happen. But you never knew. This time it might. Moist recognised that hope. It was how he'd made his living. You knew that the man running the Find the Lady game was going to win. You knew that people in distress didn't sell diamond rings for a fraction of their value. You knew that life generally handed you the sticky end of the stick. And you knew that the gods didn't pick some everyday undeserving tit out of the population and hand them a fortune. Except that, this time, you might be wrong, right? It might just happen, yes? And this was known as that greatest of treasures, which is hope. It was a good way of getting poorer really very quickly and staying poor. It could be you, but it wouldn't be. Now Moist von Lipwig headed along Attic B Street toward the Lady Sybil Free Hospital. Heads turned as he went past. He hadn't been off the front page for days, after all. He just had to hope that the winged hat and golden suit were the ultimate in furniture. People saw the gold, not the face. The hospital was still being built, as all hospitals are, but it had its own queue at the entrance. Moist dealt with that by ignoring it and going straight in. There were, in the main hallway, people who looked like the kind of people whose job it is to say, "Oi, you," when other people just wander in. But Moist generated his personal, "I'm too important to be stopped" field, and they never quite managed to frame the words. And of course, once you got past the doorway demons of any organisation, people just assumed you had a right to be there and gave you directions. Mr. Grote was in a room by himself. A sign on the door said, "Do not enter," but Moist seldom bothered about that sort of thing. The old man was sitting up in bed, looking gloomy, but he beamed as soon as he saw Moist.
"Mr. Lipwig, you're a sight for sore eyes, sir. Could you find out where they've hidden me trousers? I told them I was fit as a flea, sir, but they went and hid my trousers. Help me out of here before they carry me away to another bath, sir. A bath, sir!"
"They have to carry you," said Moist. "Can't you walk, Tolliver?"
"Yes, sir, but I fight some, sir. A bath, sir, from women. Ogling out my trumpet and skittles. I call that shameless. Everyone knows soap kills the natural effulgences, sir. Oh, sir, they're holding me prisoner, sir. They gave me a trouserectomy, sir."
"Please calm down, Mr. Grote," said Moist urgently. The old man had gone quite red in the face. "You're all right, then?"
"Just a scratch, sir. Look."
Grote unfastened the buttons of his nightshirt. "See?" he said triumphantly. Moist nearly fainted. The banshee had tried to make a tic-tac-toe board out of the man's chest. Someone else had stitched it neatly.
"Nice job of work, I'll give them that," Grote said grudgingly. "But I've got to be up and doing, sir, up and doing."
"Are you sure you're all right?" said Moist, staring at the mess of scabs.
"Right as rain, sir. I told them, sir. If a banshee can't get at me through my chest protector, none of their damned invisible little biting demons are going to manage it. I bet it's all going wrong, sir, with Aggie bossing people around. I bet it is. I bet you really need me, right, sir?"
Yes, said Moist. "Are they giving you medicine?"
"Ha! They call it medicine, sir. They give me a lot of old mumbo-pocus about it being wonderful stuff, but it's got neither taste nor smell, if you want my opinion. They say it'll do me good, but I told them it's hard work that does me good, sir, not sitting in soapy water with young women looking at my rattling flute. And they took my hair away. They called it unhygienic, sir. What a nerve! All right, it moves about a bit of its own accord, but that's only natural. I've had my hair a long time, sir, and I'm used to its funny little ways."
"What is going on here?"
said a voice full of offended ownership. Moist turned. If one of the rules that should be passed on to a young man is don't get mixed up with crazy girls who smoke like a bellows, another one should be run away from any woman who pronounces what with two H's. This woman might have been two women. She certainly had the cubic capacity, and, since she was dressed entirely in white, looked rather like an iceberg, but chillier, and with sails, and with a headdress starched to a cutting edge. Two smaller women stood behind and on either side of her, in definite danger of being crushed if she stepped backwards. "I've come to see Mr. Grote," said Moist weakly, while Grote gibbered and pulled the bedclothes over his head.
"Quite impossible.
I am the matron here, young man, and I must insist that you leave at once. Mr. Groat is in an extremely unstable condition.
He seems fine to me, said Moist. He had to admire the look the matron gave him. It suggested that Moist had just been found adhering to the sole of her shoe. He returned it with a chilly one of his own.
Young man, his condition is extremely critical, she snapped. I refuse to release him.
Madam, illness is not a crime, said Moist. People are not released from hospital, they are discharged. The matron drew herself up and out and gave Moist a smile of triumph.
That, young man, is what we are afraid of.
Moist was sure doctors kept skeletons around to cow patients.
Yeah, we know what you look like underneath.
He quite approved, though. He felt a certain fellow feeling. Places like the Lady Sybil were still very rare these days, but Moist felt certain he could make a profitable career out of wearing a white robe, using long learned names for ailments like runny nose, and looking solemnly at things in bottles. On the other side of the desk, a Dr. Lorne, he had his name on a plate on his desk, because doctors are very busy and can't remember everything, looked up from his notes on Tolliver Groat.
It was quite interesting, Mr. Lipvig. It was the first time I've ever had to operate to remove the patient's clothing, he said. You don't happen to know what the poultice was made of, do you? He wouldn't tell us.
I believe it's layers of flannel, goose grease, and bread pudding, said Moist, staring around at the office.
Bread pudding? Really bread pudding?
Apparently so, said Moist.
Not something alive, then. It seemed leathery to us, said the doctor, leafing through his notes. Ah, yes, here we are. Yes, his trousers were the subject of a controlled detonation after one of his socks exploded. We're not sure why.
He fills them with sulphur and charcoal to keep his feet fresh, and he soaks his trousers in saltpeter to prevent gnats, said Moist. He's a great believer in natural medicine, you see. He doesn't trust doctors.
Really? Said Dr. Lorne. He retains some vestige of sanity, then. Incidentally, it's best not to argue with the nursing staff. I find the best course of action is to throw some chocolates in one direction and hurry off in the other while their attention is distracted. Mr. Groat thinks that every man is his own physician, I gather.
He makes his own medicines, Moist explained. He starts every day with a quarter of a pint of gin mixed with the spirits of nitre, flour of sulphur, juniper, and the juice of an onion. He says it clears the tubes.
Good heavens, I'm sure it does. Does he smoke at all?
Moist considered this.
No, it looks more like steam, he said. And his background in basic alchemy is
non-existent, as far as I know, said Moist. He makes some interesting cough sweets, though. After you've sucked them for 2 minutes, you can feel the wax running out of your ears. He paints his knees with some sort of compound of iodine and...
Enough! Said the doctor. Mr. Lipvig, there are times when we humble practitioners of the craft of medicine have to stand aside in astonishment. Quite a long way aside in the case of Mr. Groat, and preferably behind a tree. Take him away, please. I have to say that, against all the odds, I found him amazingly healthy. I can quite see why an attack by a banshee would be so easily shrugged off. In fact, Mr. Groat is probably unkillable by any normal means, although I advise you not to let him take up tap dancing. Oh, and do take his wig, will you? We tried putting it in the cupboard, but it got out. We'll send the bill to the post office, shall we?
I thought this said free hospital on the sign, said Moist.
Broadly, yes, broadly, said Dr. Lorne. But those on whom the gods have bestowed so many favours, 150,000 of them I heard, probably have had all the charity they require,
And it's all sitting in the watch's cells, thought Moist. He reached into his jacket and produced a crumpled wad of green Ankh-Morpork $1 stamps.
Will you take these? He said.
The picture of Tiddles being carried out of the post office by Moist von Lipvig was, since it concerned an animal, considered to be full of human interest by the Times, and was thus displayed prominently on the front page. Reacher Gilt looked at it without displaying so much as a flicker of emotion. Then he reread the story next to it under the headlines. Man saves cat. Will rebuild bigger vows. As post office blazes. $150,000 gift from gods. Wave of stuck jaws hits city.
It occurs to me that the editor of the Times must sometimes regret that he has only one front page, he observed dryly.
There was a sound from the men sitting around the big table in Gilt's office. It was the kind of sound you get when people are not really laughing.
"Do you think he has got gods on his side?"
said Greenham.
"I hardly imagine so," said Gilt. "He must have known where the money was."
"You think so? If I knew where that much money was, I wouldn't leave it in the ground."
"No, you wouldn't,"
said Gilt quietly, in such a way that Greenham felt slightly uneasy.
12.5%! 12.5%!"
screamed Alphonse, bouncing up and down on his perch.
"We're made to look fools, Reacher," said Stowley. "He knew the line would go down yesterday. He might as well have divine guidance. We're losing the local traffic already. Every time we have a shutdown, you can bet he'll run a coach out of sheer devilment. There's nothing that damn man won't stoop to. He's turned the post office into a show."
"Sooner or later, all circuses leave town," said Gilt.
"But he's laughing at us," Stowley persisted. "If the trunk breaks down again, I wouldn't put it past him to run a coach to Genoa."
"That would take weeks," said Gilt.
"Yes, but it's cheaper, and it gets there. That's what he'll say. And he'll say it loudly, too. We've got to do something, Reacher."
"And what do you suggest?"
"Why don't we just spend some money and get some proper maintenance done?"
"You can't," said a new voice. "You don't have the men."
All heads turned to the man at the far end of the table. He had a jacket on over his overalls and a very battered top hat on the table beside him. His name was Mr. Pony, and he was the trunk's chief engineer. He'd come with the company and had hung on because at the age of 58, with twinges in your knuckles, a sick wife and a bad back, you think twice about grand gestures, such as storming out. He hadn't seen a Clax until 3 years ago, when the first company was founded, but he was methodical, and engineering was engineering. Currently, his greatest friend in the world was his collection of pink carbon copies. He'd done his best, but he wasn't going to carry the can when this lot finally fell over, and his pink carbon copies would see to it that he didn't. White memo paper to the chairman, yellow carbon copy to the file, pink copy you kept. No one could say he hadn't warned them. A 2-inch stack of the latest copies was attached to his clipboard. Now, feeling like an elder god leaning down through the clouds of some Armageddon and booming, "Didn't I tell you, didn't I warn you, did you listen, too late to listen now?" he put on the voice of strained patience.
"I've got 6 maintenance teams. I had 8 last week. I sent you a memo about that, got the copies right here. We ought to have 18 teams. Half the lads are needing to be taught as we go, and we ain't got time for teaching. In the old days, we'd set up walking towers to take the load, and we ain't got men even to do that now."
"All right, it'll take time, we understand," said Greenham. "How long will it take if you hire more men and get these walking towers working and..."
"You made me sack a lot of the craftsmen," said Poning.
"We didn't sack them. We let them go," said Gilt.
"We downsized," said Greenham.
"Looks like you succeeded, sir," said Pony.
He took a stub of pencil out of one pocket and a grubby notebook out of the other.
"Do you want it fast or cheap or good, gentlemen?" he said. "The way things have gone can only give you 1 out of 3.
"How soon can we have the Grand Trunk running properly?" said Greenham,
while Gilt leaned back and shut his eyes. Pony's lips moved as he ran eyes over his figures.
9 months, he said.
"I suppose, if we're seen to be working hard, 9 months of erratic running won't seem too," Mr. Stowley began.
9 months shut down," said Mr. Pony.
"Don't be a fool, man."
"I ain't a fool, sir, thank you," said Pony sharply. "I'll have to find and train new craftsmen, because a lot of the old brigade won't come back whatever I offer. If we shut the towers down, I can use the signallers. At least they know their way around a tower. We can get more work done if we don't have to drag walking towers and set them up. Make a clean start. The towers were never built that well to begin with. Dear heart never expected this sort of traffic. 9 months of dark towers, sirs."
He wanted to say, oh, how he wanted to say, "Craftsmen, do you know what that means? It means men with some pride, who get fed up and leave when they're told to do skimpy work in a rush, no matter what you pay them. So I'm employing people as craftsmen now who are barely fit to sweep out a workshop. But you don't care, because if they don't polish a chair with their arse all day, you think a man who's done a 7-year apprenticeship is the same as some twerp who can't be trusted to hold a hammer by the right end." He didn't say this aloud, because although an elderly man probably has a lot less future than a man of 20, he's far more careful about it.
You can't do better than that, said Stowley.
Mr. Stowley, I'll be doing well if it's only 9 months, said Pony, focusing again. If you don't want to shut down, I can maybe get it done in a year and a half, if I can find enough men and you're ready to spend enough money. But you'll have shutdowns every day. It'll be crippled running, sir.
This man von Lippwig will walk all over us in 9 months, said Greenham.
Sorry about that, sir. And how much will it cost? Asked Gilt dreamily, without opening his eyes. One way or t'other, sir, I reckon maybe 200,000, said Pony.
That's ridiculous! We paid less than that for a trunk! Greenham burst out.
Yes, sir, but you see, you got to run maintenance all the time, sir. The towers have been run ragged. There was that big gale back in Sektober and all that trouble in Uberwald. I haven't got the manpower. If you don't do maintenance, a little fault soon becomes a big one. I sent you gentlemen lots of reports, sir, and you cut my budget twice. I may say my lads did wonders with...
Mr. Pony, said Gilt quietly, I think what I see here is a conflict of cultures. Would you mind strolling along to my study, please? Igor will make you a cup of tea. Thank you so much.
When Pony was gone, Greenham said,
Do you know what worries me right now?
Do tell us, said Gilt, folding his hands across his expensive waistcoat.
Mr. Slant is not here.
He has apologized. He says he has important business, said Gilt.
We are his biggest clients. What's more important than us? No, he's not here because he wants to be somewhere else. The damned old revenant senses trouble, and he's never there when it all goes bad. Slant always comes out smelling of roses.
That, at least, is more fragrant than his usual formaldehyde, said Gilt. Don't panic, gentlemen.
Somebody did, said Stowley. Don't tell me that fire was accidental, was it? And what happened to poor old Fatty Horsefry, eh?
Calm down, my friends, calm down, said Gilt.
They're just merchant bankers, he thought. They're not hunters, they're scavengers. They have no vision. He waited until they had settled down and were regarding him with that strange and rather terrifying look that rich men wear when they think they may be in danger of becoming poor men.
I expected something like this, he said. Vetinari wants to harry us, that is all.
Richard, you know we'll be in big trouble if the trunk stops working, said Nutmeg. Some of us have debts to service. If the trunk fails for good, then people will ask questions.
Ugh, there's pauses, thought Gilt. Embezzlement is such a difficult word.
Many of us have had to work very hard to raise the cash, said Stowley.
Yes, keeping a straight face in front of your clients must be tricky, Gilt thought. Aloud, he said,
I think we have to pay, gentlemen, I think we do.
200,000, said Greenham. Where do you think we can get that kind of money?
You got it before, murmured Gilt.
And what is that supposed to mean, pray?
Said Greenham, with just a little too much indignation.
Poor Crispin came to see me the night before he died, said Gilt,
calm as 6 inches of snow.
Babbled about, oh, all sorts of wild things. They hardly bear repeating. I think he believed people were after him. He did, however, insist on pressing a small ledger on me. Needless to say, it is safely locked away.
The room fell silent, its silence made deeper and hotter by a number of desperate men thinking hard and fast. They were, by their own standards, honest men, in that they only did what they knew or suspected that everyone else did, and there was never any visible blood. But just now they were men far out on a frozen sea who'd just heard the ice creak.
I strongly suspect that it'll be a bit less than 200,000, said Gilt. Pony would be a fool if he didn't leave a margin.
You didn't warn us about this, Reacher, said Stowley, resentfully.
Gilt waved his hands.
We must speculate to accumulate, he said. The post office? Trickery and sleight of hand. Oh, von Lippwig is an ideas man, but that's all he is. He's made a splash, but he's not got the stamina for the long haul. Yet, as it turns out, he will do us a favour. Perhaps we have been a little smug, a little lax. But we have learned our lesson. Spurred by the competition, we are investing several hundred thousand dollars.
Several hundred? Said Greenham.
Guilt waved him into silence and continued,
"Several hundred thousand dollars in a challenging, relevant and exciting systemic overhaul of our entire organisation, focusing on our core competencies while maintaining full and listening cooperation with the communities we are proud to serve. We fully realise that our energetic attempts to mobilise the flawed infrastructure we inherited have been less than totally satisfactory, and hope and trust that our valued and loyal customers will bear with us in the coming months as we interact synergistically with change management in our striving for excellence. That is our mission."
An awed silence followed this.
"And thus we bounce back," said Guilt.
"But you said several hundred..."
Guilt sighed. "I said that," he said. "Trust me. It's a game, gentlemen, and a good player is one who can turn a bad situation to their advantage. I have brought you this far, haven't I? A little cash and the right attitude will take us the rest of the way. I'm sure you can find some more money," he added. "From somewhere, it won't be missed."
This wasn't silence. It went beyond silence.
"What are you suggesting?" said Nutmeg.
"Embezzlement, theft, breach of trust, misappropriation of funds. People can be so harsh," said Guilt.
He threw open his arms again, and a big, friendly smile emerged like the sun breaking through storm clouds.
"Gentlemen, I understand. Money was made to work, to move, to grow, not to be locked up in some vault. Poor Mr. Horsefry, I believe, did not really understand that. So much on his mind, poor fellow. But we are businessmen.
We understand these things, my friends."
He surveyed the faces of men who now knew that they were riding a tiger. It had been a good ride up until a week or so ago. It wasn't a case of not being able to get off. They could get off. That was not the problem. The problem was that the tiger knew where they lived. Poor Mr. Horsefry. There had been rumours. In fact, they were completely unsubstantiated rumours, because Mr. Grile had been excessively good at his job when pigeons weren't involved, had moved like a shadow with claws, and while he'd left a faint scent, it had been masked by the blood. In the nose of a werewolf, blood trumps everything. But rumour rose in the streets of Ankh-Morpork like mists from a midden. And then it occurred to one or two of the board that the jovial "my friends" in the mouth of Reacher Guilt, so generous with his invitations, his little tips, his advice, and his champagne, was beginning, in its harmonics and overtones, to sound just like the word "pow" in the mouth of a man in an alley who was offering cosmetic surgery with a broken bottle in exchange for not being given any money. On the other hand, they'd been safe so far. Maybe it was worth following the tiger to the kill. Better to follow at the beast's heel than be its prey.
"And now I realise I am inexcusably keeping you from your beds," said Guilt. "Good night, you gentlemen. You may safely leave everything to me. Igor?"
"Yes, master," said Igor behind him.
"Do see these gentlemen out, and ask Mr. Pony to come in."
Guilt watched them go with a smile of satisfaction, which became a bright and happy face when Pony was ushered in. The interview with the engineer went like this.
"Mr. Pony," said Guilt, "I'm very pleased to tell you that the board, impressed by your dedication and hard work you have been putting in, have voted unanimously to increase your salary by $500 a year.
Pony brightened up.
"Thank you very much, sir. That will certainly come in..." "However, Mr. Pony, as part of the management of the Grand Trunk Company, and we do think of you as part of the team, we must ask you to bear in mind our cash flow. We cannot authorise more than $25,000 for repairs this year."
"That's only about $70 a tower, sir," the engineer protested.
"Tch! Is it really? I told them you wouldn't accept that," said Guilt. "Mr. Pony is an engineer of integrity," I said. "He won't accept a penny less than $50,000, I told them.
Pony looked hunted.
"Couldn't really do much of a job, sir, even for that. I could get some walking tower teams out there, yes, but most of the mountain towers are living on borrowed time as it is."
"We're counting on you, George," said Guilt.
"Well, I suppose. Could we have the Hour of the Dead back, Mr. Guilt?"
"'I really wish you wouldn't use that fanciful term,' said Gilt. "'It really does not present the right image.'
"'Sorry, sir,' said Pony, "'but I still need it.'
Gilt drummed his fingers on the table.
"'You're asking a lot, George. You really are. "'That's revenue flow we're talking about. "'The board won't be very pleased with me if—'
"'I think I've got to insist, Mr. Gilt,' said Pony, looking at his feet.
"'And what could you deliver?' said Gilt. "'That's what the board will want to know. "'They'll say to me, "'Reacher, we're giving good old George everything he asks for. "'What will we be getting in return?'
"'Forgetting for the moment that it was a quarter of what he'd asked for, "'good old George said,
"'Well, we could patch up all round and get some of the really shaky towers "'back into some sort of order, especially 99 and 201. "'Oh, there's just so much to do.'
"'Would it?' "'For example, give us a year of reasonable service.'
Mr. Pony struggled manfully with the engineer's permanent dread of having to commit himself to anything, and managed,
"'Well, if we don't lose too many staff, and the winter isn't too bad, but of course there's always—'